In this episode, I'm joined by Quinton Wietelings, who is a history postgraduate who studied under Rico Schneller at Leuven University. He has aphorisms published in French and German and has published editions of Philosophie Zeitschrift on Emil Cioran. In this episode, we discuss the life and philosophy of Emil Cioran. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid subscribers and patrons for making all of this possible. And if you'd like to support Emetics or become part of the community, please find the links in descriptions below. Enjoy. So, Quinton Wietelings, thanks for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Yes, very honored that you're having me, James. Thank you.
So we are going to be discussing the in part the life and philosophy of Emil Cioran. And this is someone who I've been hunting for a long time to find a Cioran scholar. And it's tough. It's very tough to find someone who's spent a lot of time with him, but you have spent a lot of time with him. But before we jump into his philosophy, obviously, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came across Cioran's work, and what it is you do as well.
So I was, I graduated as a historian, James. That is the fact. But I'm not putting much of that knowledge into work. I'm having a day job in the Netherlands, and I write. What you said, like, it's hard to find a Cioran scholar, but then again, you know, is there such a thing as a real Cioran scholar in the way, you know, are there Nietzsche scholars? Of course, there are people that are very absorbed into the work, but we'll find out, you know, going this discussion that Cioran is, well, someone, he uses the aphorism a lot. So, and he wasn't out there to set up a school of philosophy, as with many thinkers that are in your podcast. And with me, my position, I have a daytime job. And next to that, I use other hours to write and read. Sometimes I lecture or give presentations. I came across Cioran on my first visit to Romania in 2007. That was a very exciting visit with one of my dear friends. And I read a bit on the country, and that, well, one of their main philosophical figures was Cioran. But only a couple of years later, I really started reading the work of Cioran. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Perhaps we'll delve back into your trip to Romania in a bit. But before we delve, you know, into that, I have to ask you the hermetics question, which is, you can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick? But we can obviously take Cioran as a given as we are discussing him.
I picked three rather obvious ones. So Cioran as a given, indeed, Emil Cioran, another philosopher much discussed on your podcast, Ernst Jünger. Mm-hmm. And as a third, I would pick Lev Chestov. I haven't come across him in your podcast yet. He was birth name Yehuda Leib Schwarzman, born in Kiev. But he was one of the Russian intellectuals who fled after the revolution to the West, to Paris. And this is something these three thinkers have in common. They all resided in Paris, and possibly they may talk in French during the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And of course, Emil Cioran and Ernst Jünger knew each other relatively well. Cioran went to stay with Jünger, and Jünger went to stay with Cioran in his flat, and Cioran, obviously, was it Klages or was it Jünger that Cioran said was the most accomplished man he'd ever met? I think that was Klages. But it always seems strange to me that they got on so well, considering there seems to be, at face value, a very clear divide between their work, between Jünger and Cioran. So I don't know what you make of that.
Yes, certainly. So I'd be listening in on this conversation because there are so many differences. With Lev Chestov, Cioran befriended the most important pupil of Chestov. There was Benjamin Fondane, who also lived in Paris and was persecuted by the Nazis. That's a very interesting story altogether. But surely, what you say, Cioran and Jünger, they have their differences. Mm-hmm. Cioran looked up to Jünger. He was definitely impressed by this soldier figure from Germany. This was something that impressed me. But having said that, not all of Junger's readings and writings must have connected to what Charon really liked. Like what is known is that Junger did advise Charon to read the works of Léon Blois, reactionary Catholic thinker, lived in France and Denmark, but that was not Charon's cup of tea, for instance. So there is it rubs. I mean, different opinions on both sides. Yes,
and it seems to me as well that there's a strange, for me, the strange thing that's going on there is that Choron, at face value, perhaps, I know we both don't agree with this, but it's the typical reading of Choron is one of despair and sort of submission to the world and hopelessness. And whereas Junger is sort of the antithesis of this. He's gone through so much. He's almost taken everything that life could throw at a man and come out the other side every single time as this sort of glaring hero figure. And Junger is someone who absolutely overcame everything set in his path. And Choron did it in a certain way, but he writes about it as if it can never be overcame. And this is what I sort of interests me, is whether Choron ever took anything on board, or, you know, from what we can consider Junger's philosophy.
Like my answer may be a bit obscene, but this is really in the work of Choron. What makes this difference is Choron came from Romania, newly formed country, end of the 19th century. Very turbulent start of the 20th century, had its ups and downs. Junger, on the other hand, came from Germany, big country. Whilst Charon was still working on his ideas of political philosophy, that was before his definite move to France, he made a difference between the destiny of small countries and the destiny of big countries. He really saw big countries had something to say, had something to decide in the faith of the world and of mankind. And for a small country as Romania, he would want their destiny to be linked to that of a big country, such as Germany, Russia. So that is how Charon said. I hope this connects a bit to your question, where you're going to. Mm-hmm. Seems like really strange for us. A thinker, a philosopher, thinking that way, but that was important to Charon for sure.
Did you get that impression when you went to Romania? That was a clear part of its history, that it sort of had this extremely turbulent start, and it felt relatively sort of new.
There you enter a new dimension, because Charon was read before the Second World War. All his work was banned after the Second World War. Junger, of course, had a ban on writing himself, an imposed ban by the occupied forces after the war. But later on, well, he kept writing in German. He was he kept being read. He was also appreciated in France a lot, even though he fought both wars in France. The new dimension is Charon. During the communist era of Ceausescu, was not read in Romania. It was forbidden to read his work. But there was a zine of his name, of course, Charon, this Romanian writer who made a legacy for himself abroad, who was a person, who was an important Romanian. So there was a huge interest after the fall of communism, of course, in Romania to delve into that work. And there's only one, two generations that are doing that now. So of course the reception over there is very interesting and very different from Junger's reception in his own country, Germany.
Mm-hmm. And there was for Choron, there is this sort of clear split in his work. There is, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, three or four books written in Romanian, and then he makes this very clear, you know, he goes to France and begins to write solely in French. And do you think there's a clear difference between the works written in Romania and the ones written when he was in France?
I'm able to read the work of scholars. There is a publisher in Paris, and there is a professor from Sibiu, Gentiana Michaela Stanizor, whom I was lucky enough to meet. And she organized lots of meetings, and she also organizes publications on Ciaran by Romanian scholars, students. So it's very interesting to read that they do seem a bit of a change in tone, and she clearly states that in her latest book, which is called L'amour éthique de Ciaran, and the subtitle is Dissolution of the Me in his writings, where she offers a really narrow analysis of the work. It's a very recent piece of work, but then again, you know, there's only so much available of Ciaran in English. Mm-hmm. And of his notes. What do we find? Well, I'm not a Romanian, so I wouldn't be able to tell. But there have been a lot of publications. Ciaran was afraid from off the 70s that a lot of his Romanian publications would get known in France. And because he wrote for magazines, it's not just the books he wrote. He wrote journals for and journal entries, like very hefty political pieces in the magazines. There was a proper scene in Romania ongoing. Bucharest was lively. French language was all around. German language was all around. Ciaran grew up with a number of Romanian intellectuals, of whom we should definitely know Mircea Eliade and the theater maker Ionescu. So, like the divide, he's a real writer, Ciaran, because there's the notebooks, there's now the political pieces, there are still publications. There's lawsuits ongoing of the publication. So gradually we discover what he wrote in Romanian. And then there's, of course, what he tells himself. Like he says of his first work, On the Heights of Despair, which means as much as On the Summits of Despair, that this was his most essential work. And he still considers this the quintessential work of understanding him. Certainly, so as a concluding comment, certainly when it comes to the theme of the work of the philosopher Ciaran, all is there from of the beginning. That despair, death, religion, God, all those themes are right there at the beginning, and that hasn't changed at any time.
Yeah, Ciaran, for one thing, On the Heights of Despair is sort of almost a joint favorite for me. I would almost say it is my favorite, simply for the fact that as someone's debut philosophical text and sort of first ever book and first ever attempt to encapsulate how it is they are perceiving the world, it is an absolute sort of just acidic punch. You know, it's incredible that someone could write that as their first book. And Ciaran is this rarity, like you said, in that it doesn't change throughout his whole career. And that's not to say that he sort of stays stagnant and doesn't move position to a certain extent. But the problem with Ciaran, which we'll find, is that there isn't a traditional idea of a position in his work. It's sort of, he begins his trajectory from free-floating ideas such as despair and such as death, instead of creating a point or a sort of point of focus or system, and then viewing death and despair from these are taken first. These are taken like as the first things that he's seeing, entropy and decay and things along these lines. And I think this is probably sort of the, perhaps it's a bit early on to answer this huge question, but I think it's probably the most important one. Before we had a call before this, because Ciaran is one of my favorite philosophers, so I sort of wanted to make sure we got this right. We had a call before this, and me and you both agreed that actually you can find a very strange form of hope in Ciaran's work. And for those who haven't read Charon, he writes some of the bleakest, you know, most despair, most sort of hellish and gut-wrenching philosophy that anyone could write. And in certain places, he just won't be topped. You know, he's called the last Nietzsche, and he puts more in a sentence than most people will put in a book. And yet there is hope in this. Now, this is a huge question, obviously, but what can we make of Charon's philosophical outlook? You know, from day one, he's here with this philosophy of despair.
I can really agree with what you're saying there, James. There's a quote of Witold Gombrowicz, a Polish writer, and he says, "Charon's words reek of a basement coolness and the rot of a grave, but they are too pretty." And Gombrowicz, he had an exchange of letters. He was a Polish nobleman. He came from a noble family. And by chance, he was on a boat to Argentina when the war broke out, and he never saw his country again, Poland. This goes with Charon as well, of course. You know, he never went to Romania again. And I agree furthermore that reading Charon brings me joy, certainly. So I started reading Charon as a history student in my last year in Belgium. And then I slowly got my hand to everything I could find. There were some Dutch translations. None of his Romanian works are translated to Dutch, unfortunately, and some have become quite rare. Then I also picked up some English translations. And when I was at his former home of his parents in Rajinari in the Carpathian Mountains, I was there with two Romanian professors. They did a bit of a guided tour for me. So I'm very thankful for that. It was a lovely experience, as you can imagine, for someone who's delving into the work of a writer. We went to the graveyard where his parents and his brother lay buried. And I cracked a joke to one of the professors. I said, like, because there is this quote of Charon where he says that as a child, he has so good childhood memories of playing on the mountainside and with local farmers or what have you. And he would also play near to the graveyard. And he was sometimes given by the graveyard manager skulls. And then he would play football with the skulls. So I cracked the joke whilst I was there at the graveyard, like, you know, where can we buy skulls for playing football? Also, I took one of the books of Charon with me, of course, because, you know, on traveling, you want to read someone. And the professor also remarked, he said, "Well, Quentin, my experience is that with all the Charon scholars I meet, they kind of cherish his work and they bring it with them because it's like a pension. It's hopeful. It's very forgiving. It's something you can really live by. I guess it's his work."
Mm-hmm. And so, in what sense, you know, I'm sure that you have an interest in you know, other philosophers. Of course, you have an interest in other philosophers. In what sense did you, or could we, place Charon philosophically? Because there is obviously this famous quote that he's the last Nietzschean. And I understand, I can't remember where that quote comes from, but I understand it to a certain extent. But I also think that Charon wouldn't agree with that.
No, what Charon... Charon read Nietzsche on an early age. He had access in Romania already to lots of works. So whilst he was writing this Heights of Despair, we need to put our minds in the context where he was. He was drawn away from this paradise, which was his birth village, Rajinari. He was taken to Sibiu, to the big city. He's describing this, that he was put on a cart with horses, and he wouldn't see his mom or dad. He was just brought there. strange city where people would also talk strange languages, fairly strange, because it would be German speaking, Hungarian speaking, Romanian speaking to some extent, French. And he would read extensively. That's what he would like to do. He would wander in nights because he was suffering from insomnia. This is a very famous story about Chiron suffering from insomnia for a large piece of his life. This is also what connected him to Nietzsche. So he says this insomnia, this sickness, this is what defines a person, and this is where he draws strength from. So this is certainly something Nietzschean. What more happened these days, these student days, these long nights, is he would wander around, he would visit prostitutes, he would really like to converse with prostitutes, with shepherds, like really low life people, because he would expect to find wisdom in the conversations with these people. And last of all, he had the readings. His dad had a very extensive Russian library, so that's where he found the works of many Russian philosophers and thinkers. So not just Nietzsche. I mean, we think nihilism in Europe, that it's a German word, or it comes from German philosophy, but that is not the case. I mean, nihilism was already there in Russia. And it was utilized by Nekrashev, known to Dostoevsky. The Russian nihilism was of a different branch than the European one. So yes, extensive readings, Chiron, well, Nietzsche was one of those, together, of course, with Schopenhauer. And then all the Russian thinkers, of whom I think Shestov is really the most interesting one. That's why I put him in that conversation. But not to forget Dostoevsky as a novelist. And that's how he developed all the ideas that come into the Heights of Despair. It does look a lot like Nietzsche. Where he parts from Nietzsche is, well, he says this Übermensch, the overman, he finds that a phony and theatrical figure, and this is not what Chiron can connect to. Also, the eternal return. These are concepts that are not embraced by Chiron. He wants to move on. So later on, he denies the influence of Nietzsche more and more.
Does he ever comment as to why he finds the Übermensch and the eternal return sort of bad ideas?
He does certainly at places and in his personal notes, but it also comes from his experience in Germany. He obtained a scholarship to study in Germany. He was settled in Berlin and Munich, and he was very disappointed by what he considered like the big German tradition. Well, we already discussed the big countries, small countries, but all these systemic thinkers, this is something he definitely didn't like. So he tended more to other philosophers like Lacan, like Simmel. He found much more interest in those. There's a very important comment he makes on Nietzsche and of the study of Nietzsche in, I think it's from The Trouble with Being Born, where he says every philosopher or thinker that wants to invent a kind of system behind all Nietzsche's thought is being unfaithful, untruthful to what Nietzsche really, really means. That's what I can say about that, James.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you think he was definitely a philosopher or a thinker? I mean, it's tough to say whether or not we can consider Chiron a philosopher, really. But do you think his thought was inherently antagonistic towards systems such as, you know, Kant or, you know, Hegel or people along these lines?
Definitely. No discussion about that. And we have to move once more to, I think, finding something very I call it obscene, like the big countries, the small countries. There was one thing Chiron promised to himself and said to others, that he didn't want to work for money. He never intended to work or get a job, and he succeeded in that for almost all of his life. So in this respect, we should consider Chiron's life a success, and he would have considered it a success himself. And we should also consider it as an intellectual career, which has now become virtually impossible. The only thing Chiron ever did was he took a job as a high school teacher in Brasov for 1 year, and he hated it. Hmm. He got there's a very, very, very famous quote. Well, I like it a lot. He is in Brasov, also a lovely town in the Carpathian Mountains. And Chiron was very hard to deal with the colleagues he worked with, the other professors. He would go to a bar, and he was so obsessed by the reading of Shakespeare. Like Shakespeare was everything to him. He found lots of wisdom in Shakespeare. And if you read Shestov, you will find that, you know, certain analyses, they match one-on-one, the ones from Shestov and Chiron. So Chiron was so into the world of Shakespeare that he sat alone in the bar at a table, and one of his colleagues came up to him to strike a conversation, and the only thing he said is, "Are you Shakespeare?" Hmm. And his colleague said, "No." He said, "Well, then what use is there of talking to you?" What? So no jobs. He obtained a scholarship to do his PhD on Bergson in Paris, something he never completed. Bergson, in the end, was his verdict that Bergson didn't have enough sense for tragedy. And he lived near the university for many years. He lived in several hotel rooms. He ate in the university canteen well into his 30s, 40s. Until someone came to him and told him that he's not a student. And next to that, he never had to take on a job.
So he only made money from his writings, or did he have some other form of support?
He was definitely poor some of those days. And very important support to Chiron was Simone Bouet, who was French, but she was an English teacher. And she supported him a lot throughout. His writings, his first book in French only got published in 1949. So until then, it was tough. But he was seen as an intellectual figure and sometimes invited at posh people's houses. And he would have free meals and, you know, just strike up conversations with others and be there as a kind of an ornament to the philosophical, to whatever was going on at that time.
Did he ever go to sort of conferences or meetings, or did he sort of hate that kind of thing?
No, there was not so much an intellectual circle he moved in. He sat close to Sartre and Camus at the Café de Fior, but he never took part in those conversations. What he did do in the French years, which cured him from his insomnia, so he says, is he took on long bike rides to the southern part of the area. And, you know, he would just travel through the countryside for 100 kilometers, and all this physical exercise, he says, made him recover from his sickness. And he took notes, very small notes. I've been given a very rare edition of some of this very small paperwork, where he was still writing in Romanian. And this was also when he decided to move on writing in French, because he was trying to land a job as a translator of certain French authors, Mallarmé, Montaigne, De Maistre. And whilst translating Mallarmé, he thought, well, you know, what am I doing, actually, you know, trying to translate this French to Romanian? You know, I might as well just write in French. And that's where the French author Chiron started.
Before we move too far into his specific philosophy, which would be quite a tough thing to move into, and his later life. There's one interesting sort of fact which happens in his younger days, which he does eventually just completely sort of say, no, that was young me, it was silly. But he was considered by some when he was younger to be a Hitlerist, and he was also a fan of Kodorianu, who was the leader of the Iron Guard. And, you know, these are extremely right-wing positions. And also, later on, he has an obsession with Joseph de Maistre, the French reactionary writer. Now, this is sort of strange for people who come across Turan's writing and not know his biography. You wouldn't really see this. And, you know, we'll start with Hitler and Kodorianu. What was Turan's obsession there?
So Turan was part of a group of intellectuals in Romania at that time, in the 30s. They were all publishing in the same magazines, and they were also, most of them were students under one professor, Nae Ionescu. And famous students were Mircea Eliade, the later professor of religious studies. Well, this is also what they were studying, like comparative religions. Constantin Noica, a very famous Romanian philosopher who stayed in Romania after the war, and Michael Sebastian, a Jewish writer of whose literary works have become very, very popular. What was their main concern was, of course, the future, the political future of the country. And this is perhaps where Turan says, well, I slipped. So he wrote a book called The Transfiguration of Romania, a kind of political program, which was at that time already very different from all other political. I mean, tendencies were nasty and gnarly in Romania. What he wrote was certainly also influenced by Oswald Spengler's The Decline of the West. We must put ourselves in this time frame of the 30s, what was going on in Europe. So Turan was found on this right wing. That's the one tract he wrote, The Transfiguration of Romania, which was later published in French, but then he fought real hard to have all the anti-Semitic sentences removed, or even an entire chapter was removed for the French translation. Another tract, another book he published was Of Tears and Saints. You mentioned that earlier in a conversation as well, which was focusing more on the religion. It's a beautiful book where he talks a lot about God, and now we would really consider it to be written by a religious person. I mean, a skeptic, but religious nonetheless. But that was a big breach with his parents, and also came as a shock to Romania. All in all, these works made that Turan was an interesting figure in the intellectual field of Romania, albeit not someone very useful to the ones fighting for power. Having said that, he moved to Germany in 1933. He was in Berlin. He was at the big Nazi manifestations, and boy, was he impressed. I mean, this was him coming from a small country, divided, and, you know, just meeting all these Germans, the suits, the music, the rhetoric. This grabbed him. This was something he was truly enthusiastic about. And, poor thing is, he wrote it all down and sent it to his Romanian friends, saying, well, what's happening here in Germany is truly terrific. You can discuss, you know, whether how much that's forgivable. Of course, I'll not go into that there. And the same with Kodorianu later. So there's some gray areas about what happened after those years, 33, even when he was in Paris, 42, there's like half a year, there's a gap which is unaccounted for, where scholars are still not sure whether he went back to Romania and how long he exactly stayed there and how he was, how his safety was guaranteed during the occupation of the German regime. Mm-hmm. Having said that, later on he didn't like any of the anti-Semitic things he said on his deathbed. He was told to have told his friends that he's not an anti-Semite, and he did come up for his friend, the Shestov scholar Benjamin von Dahn. He pleaded at the Nazis for his release when he was taken hostage, but this was in vain because Benjamin von Dahn, he was executed in Auschwitz at the end of the war, unfortunately.
And obviously, this isn't. I don't read French, so his work on Joseph de Maistre is one of the ones which hasn't been translated yet. And this is a sort of a strange obsession as well. I'm not sure if you've read the work, but what can we make of Choron's obsession with de Maistre?
I skipped that. There's just so many. There's an entire life with Choron, and it's hard to just skip by. It's important to have this said in English. What can we make of the matter? I do think that you can find something in English. In there's a French book called the Exercice d'Admiration, which is a compendium of all kinds of people he knew, or Joseph de Maistre, of course, he didn't know, or he read and admired, and he wrote biographical entries on them. And there is one on Joseph de Maistre as well, and I think you can access it in English if you're lucky. Hmm. Joseph de Maistre, certainly a reactionary thinker. I studied some of his work. Well, I read St. Petersburg Dialogues, which Joseph de Maistre, there is a parallel, of course, here with Choron. Choron had to flee Romania, and de Maistre had to flee Savoy, his country. So there's an obvious parallel, of course, where Choron's interest comes from. And then de Maistre thinks of political power, great power, religious power, absolute power. This is all very interesting to Choron. Plus the French, with the French, he admires the French style of writing. So there's, when it comes to aphorisms, the moralist, the French moralist, he wants to be that writer. And that is exactly what he tries to do in his first book. So Paul Valéry, de Maistre, Rivarol, this is the people he look up to, and he wants to be like. On the other hand, the debate in France is, of course, very different from what's going on in Germany and what he's used to in Romania with the in France with the laïcité, so the standardized secularization of society. And Joseph de Maistre is someone who goes really against that. He is a conservative, very much unlike Burke, for instance, in your tradition. Joseph de Maistre, he's when he talks about serfdom and absolute power, he's breaking boundaries, and that has been influential to thinkers before and after Choron, so that grab.
Good chunk of biography there, and I think we'll probably dip back into biography at some point. But I sort of want to move into his philosophy, which is, you know, I when I was coming up with the questions for this and thinking about this interview, I just, you know, I sort of hit a wall because, you know, for instance, with Nietzsche's philosophy, you could begin with his theorizations on time or the tightrope between animal to man to Superman or the idea of overcoming. With Kant, you would begin with a critique of pure reason. With Choron, however, because it's not a systematic philosophy, it's just a nihilist philosophy, assembled largely from aphorisms. And even when he does write outside of what we could call an aphoristic frame, it's never anything pages and pages long. I think I'll begin with the statement that Choron's philosophy is nihilistic, but I don't personally think it's nihilistic in the sense that it's someone who's sort of screaming at the universe and saying, oh, this is so meaningless, this is so meaningless. So in what way do you think we can understand Choron's philosophy of nihilism? Or nihilism?
It's interesting. I picked up one word of this question you put up here. It's like that you met a wall. Mm-hmm. One of the things Gabriel Marcel said of Lev Shestov is that, you know, there were, of course, philosophers breaking down walls in the 30s, but he says Lev Shestov is knocking on a wall where there is not. It's a funny thing. He was very important to Choron, which I already pointed out, based on, inspired by Dostoevsky, Pascal, Kierkegaard. Those essays of Shestov on those thinkers must have also influenced Choron, and that lineage is very clear. Another inquiry would be Buddhism. Choron was very interested in the Eastern religions, and he was very envious of Mircea Eliade as well. So the fellow Romanian student whom we've talked to, who would become a celebrity when it comes to the study of religions. He was Romanian and he resided in India for almost a year, I guess. And he would write to Romania about his experiences there. So Choron was obviously very triggered by that as well. Like spiritual, we're talking here about Eastern spirituality and you will find it in all his texts. His final conclusion, however, about the Eastern spirituality would be that the meditation and the dissolution of the self was something that the Oriental man, like him, like a Carpathian with warm blood running through his veins, would not be able of. So he cut that. He had the interest, but you know he didn't venture into that more. And then there's other lineage, like the Bogomils, a people who were into a kind of Gnostic religion, you could say, that that inhabited Romania. He sought lineage there, and he was very inspired by Christian mystics, Saint John of the Cross, Teresa from Avila, Meister Eckhart, and before that, he would be very interested in, and I am currently reading now a thesis of a Belgian scholar of the hermits, the early Christian hermits. He would, like one of his sayings would be, and maybe this answers a bit your question. I mean, it's cryptical, but one of his sayings would be like, for every hermit with success, there would also be hermits without success. So you can venture into the desert to try become a hermit, but then there's people who come back or, you know, just fail at doing that.
Mm-hmm. I think I'm not very well read on Kierkegaard, but I believe there's a Kierkegaard quote along the same lines where he says, to have or to have not, right? You know, there's always I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, because the idea of the hermits is that the universe is sort of not necessarily in equilibrium, but there's an inherent frustration with the ability towards sort of a unification or purity, whereas, you know, the Kierkegaard quote I was alluding to is to have or to have not, you know, to have or to have not tried. It's like either way, to have tried or to have not tried, there's always going to be the inherent note of the antithesis within the thesis. So like you try to do something, there's always this idea of like whether or if you hadn't done it, what would have been different, etc., etc. Now there's like probably this is probably like the most controversial aspect of Choron's thought, considering, you know, if you when you first go into Choron's thought, this is someone who comes across as someone who doesn't enjoy life, who's someone who sort of hates the cosmos, which is, I just don't think this is the way to read it, but this is how you'll read it the first time. It's very bleak and there's a lot of despair, and he comments on it quite a lot, but he is sort of relatively infamous for talking about suicide. And I know, like, we both sort of enjoy the anecdotes of Choron's on suicide. So, perhaps if you could just sort of articulate Choron's position about what someone should do when they wish to end their life.
Yeah, because you said earlier on in a conversation with me, I started rereading on Tears and Saints, because you said you liked that book so much. And in the German edition I have, they singled out one sentence of Chiron, and where he says, the duty of a lonely person is to get more lonely. Yeah, that may sound harsh for these times. I mean, are you allowed to say that to lonely persons, to people experiencing solitude? But that's what he's pushing. And with suicide, it is no different. So here he says, when people come to me saying they want to kill themselves, I tell them, what's your rush? You can kill yourself anytime you like. So calm down. Suicide is a positive act. He says, you know, only optimists, they commit suicide. A suicidal person is a optimist who can no longer be optimistic. And he had, let's not be mistaken. It's hard for certain people to venture into the texts of Chiron. Mm-hmm. But he is a revered writer. Like in France, for the style of French writing in the 20th century, he's way up there, considered like one of the most important writers.
With the suicide idea and the loneliness idea, for Chiron, then there's this acceptance within his philosophy. But do you think this, you know, this just accept the way things are to a certain degree and almost like push them and see what happens when you push them? Do you think this is different to Albert Camus' myth of Sisyphus? You know, this idea that you have to keep rolling the boulder up the hill, but every single day, etc. The ongoing Sisyphean task of life, the constant work of life. Do you think that Chiron's acceptance of life is different to that?
That is a good question, and it's tough to answer because those they really diverge, Camus and Chiron. In a way, they're tied together. They were at the same publishing house, Gallimard. They frequented the same cafes, and they were both very much inspired by Lev Shostov. Once again, a forgotten philosopher. But I recommend you read it. You know, maybe you make another podcast on that one. Let's come to what I was trying to say in the previous question, that Chiron was met with suicidal people. This also why I was trying to prove the point that he was a very important writer. I mean, most important of all, Samuel Beckett. He was a close friend of, and he also ended up in fights with Samuel Beckett. But next to that, Henri Michaux and Paul Celan. Paul Celan, one of the most important German poets, a Jew who had to flee Chernowitz, and who grew up in the German-speaking part of Chernowitz, and then ended up in Paris and became the translator of the first French work of Chiron. And eventually, Celan committed suicide. He drifted. And Chiron writes down in his notebooks quite carefully that he gets calls from friends who are suicidal and how he deals with that. Is he Sisyphus? Does he support Sisyphus? I'm struggling to give you the one answer on this question. Regarding other people, he was quite clear how he would position himself. But then on the other hand, so he talked a lot about this suicide. And some people wonder, like, why did Chiron not commit suicide himself? He ended up, well, almost senile, being in a care home. I don't think there's a contradiction in there. The most important thing to understand from Chiron's thinking is that the thought of suicide helps him. Mm-hmm. So it is not but the ability. Plus, he says, you always commit suicide too late. So it is this thought, this is the support act, as would the Christian mystics have their dark nights or their spiritual enlightened experience. This was it. It was a theoretical abstract thought that he really needed help on. The closest he may have come to suicide, well, but it's speculative. But he wrote notebooks on Ibiza. He would frequent Spain often, and he would be lonely there and write about suicide, being alone on the beach. He would really go into it there. These are called the Talamanca notebooks, by the way. Also should also be available in English.
And with this idea that, you know, he there's this the famous quote from his mother, where she says that if she knew he was going to be so miserable, she would have had him aborted. And of course, that's also extremely liberating for Choron from a young age, in that he says that once his mother said that to him, that she would have had him aborted if she knew he'd have been this miserable, that he sort of realized in that moment that he was like a cosmic mistake, like it doesn't matter. And from then on, he just saw himself as like this just accident of the universe, which is just sort of floating around. So yeah, like just in terms of his, I just think that's an important one to put in there in terms of his views towards suicide, is that the way in which he saw himself wasn't as like someone, a philosopher with like a teleology or purpose, it seems to me. And also, like, relating to Beckett, I always found it funny that the few English bits that have been translated relating to his relationship with Beckett is that early on he was so terrified to even approach him in the parks, which I always found quite funny.
Yes, because Chiron is someone who values solitude and other people's solitude. You commented very beautiful on this quote by his mother. Indeed, Chiron realizing that, you know, he's just an accident. You know, he may as well not be there. That's also with his experiences in Romania. He said, you know, I talked to shepherds and prostitutes, and they knew about life in ways that were beyond me. They had things to tell that no other German professor would ever be able to tell me. When I was in school, I think I must have been like 14, 15 years old, I had a teacher of Greek and Latin, and we were all school kids. He once told us, he said, well, you know, it's very healthy and it's very good that when you're 14 or 15 years old, you think of yourself as the center of the universe. This comes real close to solipsism, but it is a liberating thought. I mean, you are just floating around, and it's a helpful way to perceive things like that. That is how I experienced it.
So from this, you know, people might gain the idea that Choron is an antinatalist. Do you think he's against life, that he thinks it should be ended, or do you think that for Choron there's anything in life worth experiencing?
It is to be endured, for sure. asked for his occupation, he would say, "I endure life." That doesn't sound very fancy. The antinatalism is certainly interesting, and I've been interviewed and questioned by groups who are venturing into this antinatalism thought, and Choron is one of the thinkers. Made the pathway for modern thoughts on antinatalism. One of the quotes of Choron saying that if I would have had kids, I would have eaten them. That sounds very... It's a stylistic element of Choron. If you do very close reading on his text, you can see that in his text, like usually at the beginning of an essay, or there's like a very shocking statement, and that is what makes it extremely readable. Like this one, like for instance, eating children, or he would say, the first thought that comes up to me when I leave the house and venture into the city is extermination. And funny enough, this was also one thought left out in the first German translation that came. It wasn't mentioned as left out, but it's an interesting fact, of course. So, but Chiron is a thinker who had to deal with himself, so someone who didn't want to work, someone who wanted to comment on everything and not in search of power, not looking for any political philosophy. I think he considered that a bit of a mistake, you could say. He would never comment on politics anymore. Was he above it? Was he beyond it? And there are certain themes in his work where he would try to unravel all his philosophical potential. And the antinatalist thought is one of those, you know, especially in the book, The Trouble with Being Born. And then there's others as well, such as The Fall Out of Time. It's also a book of his, like his experience of having fallen out of time. He says some people fall in time. And I happen to also, you know, to not just fall in time, but fall right out of it. The insomnia is something he conceptualized, and his thoughts on suicide. So these are strains in his work that come back. And also, again, this antinatalist thought is also something, there's lineage. I mean, there's other thinkers who posed it as well, and he picked it up from there. Is there a one clear stance saying that Chiron, he did not have any children. He did have one lifelong partner, and then he did have romantic affairs with other women. Yes. And he had huge respect for his mother, and his father. But well, having said that, he was stranded in France with no possibility of returning to his home country. His brother got taken, was put in prison. Also a very, very important figure in Romania, Aurel Cioran. And both his parents died without him being there. And he got invitations to go to Romania after the fall of communism, never did. Yeah, there's lots of depth to the persona of Cioran in there. You get where I'm going with this?
Definitely. Considering that he is sort of placed within his biography, a lot is happening. There's a lot of events going on. He's caught up in a lot of things. In what way does this affect his sort of philosophical reading of history and how he views what history is? Do you think he is anti-Hegelian in the sense that, you know, this idea of falling out of time and things just being a bit disjointed, this seems to me that he wouldn't subscribe to the sort of the mode of history that we find in Hegel.
This is certainly one thought I'm working on now, trying to compose an essay. This is what I find the most interesting string of thought in Chiron. And as I have also read by some commentators, you know, the thesis of the end of history, Chiron was there years before communism fell. He was writing it out. He says, we're witnessing it all. This history, everything being swept away, the impossibility of meaning, the dissolution of institutes. So he was describing that to himself, you know, without any program, any political program or sympathy. And that is, to me, where is his real strength. History itself. And so I was educated as a historian, but it is meaningless. It doesn't get us anywhere. It's dead weight laying on us. And Chiron doesn't describe it as much as did perhaps the modernists of the 20s, the 30s, who were really trying to get on. But Charan sees it and he acknowledges it. And this is where he does align with Ernst Jünger, of course. There's nothing to pride ourselves on in the history. And that is certainly anti-Hegelian. We should step away from that. There's nothing to have from it. Makes you wonder what is left. You know, is that just decay, pessimism, violence? What you say? Well, he does exhibit violence as, you know, a key tract of people. Perhaps you're also known with the work of René Girard. Mm-hmm. Violence and the sacred, you know, is the theory that there is a constitutional violence, or even, you know, a sacred dissolution through violence that makes mankind. That is what I'm into now, and I think Charon's reading of history is very interesting because it touches on this nihilism and it kind of embraces it, you know. We should have nihilism at work in our history, because what is history? Is it the artifacts? I couldn't care less for some statues being torn down, you know, people already not knowing what those statues are about. I mean, I'm enjoying this day and age very much. I don't know how it is about you, James.
With regards to the statues being torn down, I think my frustration with it is that, as far as I can see, they're being torn down for purely narcissistic reasons. I don't, you know, like you said, that I think the actual history of the statues isn't known. So I think they're being torn down. The process of them being torn down is a symbol in itself of the process, but it's not a symbol with regards to the destroying some racist monument, because I don't think the knowledge is actually there. Like the average statue that you see dotted here and there, I don't think people know the history of that thing unless they've studied it, which is very, very, very rare. So it seems to me like an almost just a complete spontaneous act of frustration aimed at whatever can be justified socially as an okay form of violence. You know, there's just something, there's normally always some way that you can go out and perform violence which is socially vindicated to a certain degree. But yeah, that would be my reading on it. I don't know what Charon would say.
No, I wouldn't know either. And I sense in myself that I'm really taken away with what happens in the world and in politics. And at times it's much nicer to see it from afar. That's also what he describes. I mean, looking from the planet of a terrible height, you know, we all look kind of alike and pettiless. This is, of course, an interesting viewpoint. Our cosmic qualities aren't that great.
Well, this would have been a viewpoint that he probably was extremely influenced by Jünger and Jünger's novel, specifically Umspiel, in which the concept of the anarch, if you've come across that, someone who's just entirely, Jünger describes the anarch as the anarchist gets involved in the political ongoings, the activism, the debates and the riots, and the anarch witnesses them, perceives them, sort of thinks his things, but stays back, watches from afar. The anarch is the sovereign individual who sort of lets the world be, so to speak.
No, certainly, and that is exactly what I'm the text I'm reading right now. So the Eumenspiel of Jünger. So this earlier on, he says in The Worker, Jünger. So yeah, I'm setting up this essay on the history. Jünger already concludes in The Worker. So this is written in the 30s, and that he says that our world looks more like a museum. And he says the difficulty with this is that the museum brings forth an atmosphere which is suffocating and grotesque. And this is a kind of historical fetishism. And that what determines our lack of production or lack of creative production. And certainly that is because, there is a creative act in destruction possible. I think both Junger and Chiron keep that open. So, well, tearing down statues, I mean, go for it. I mean, I'm all yours. I applaud it.
Is there anything you would like to add about Chiron and his philosophy or him himself that we haven't touched on yet?
Well, I tried to look back on the conversation. Him coming from a smaller country, Romania. This is one interesting bit. I'm Dutch myself. He makes few remarks about the Dutch in From the Heights of Despair. And strangely enough, we were a world power once, as were also Portugal. But and Chiron does describe, well, does mention it somewhere in the book. But actually, we were two smaller countries to be real dominant world powers. Chiron is a quintessential European figure. He has a great interest in English culture as well. Like I said, his life partner in France was Simone Bouet. She's buried next to him in Paris. She was an English teacher, and Chiron was, he really liked English poetry, W.H. Auden, and then there's other writers such as Swift. He really revered them. German culture, he was in there, he studied there. His commandment of German was really good. There's interviews to be heard on the internet by Chiron in German, and that is a splendid talk. I really appreciate that. The French culture, which he made his own, his obsession for Spain, where he traveled several times. He had friends there. Important intellectuals like Savater and Maria Zambrano. They were his friends and they liked his work. Chiron is a European figure in this sense of the word. I don't know if English British have a sense for this. This is one thing I would really want to point out. And for the transmission of his work, I mean, not all is yet available in English. I saw one of your tweets the other day where you said, well, I'm hoping that his notebook is getting translated in English. That would definitely help. But he's to be understood as a European figure.
Yeah, okay. I think that's a good place to finish up, unless you've, anything more to add. But I think that's we gave it a good shot.
Okay, I certainly hope so, and hoping we make other people enthusiastic and raving to each other.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.